crank it up once more. Welcome back to another episode of Michael's Motor Island, powered by Pennzoil, where motor oil is in motion. From the track to the road, Pennzoil is the most trusted motor oil brand in America and the official motor oil of the NTT IndyCar Series. My friends out there, we have a special guest, and I'm telling you, special, because I got to tell you, I am starstruck. Let me tell you, we have Reese Millen, and that last name speaks for itself. You got Rod Millen, hill climbing. We're talking rally racing, the whole family. If you get a chance, Google it, go over to YouTube. You're going to see some fantastic, fantastic footage of Reese, who we have on hand, along with his family. It's unbelievable, but we just going to jump in on Reese. Reese, thank you for joining us today. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me here.
Oh, man, we're glad to have you. I tell you, Reese, I'm going to briefly tell some of our people just slightly a little bit of your background. I got to tell you, we're talking big time rally driver. And we're going to get into what you're doing a couple of months ago and the hill climb over at Pikes Peak. But just to briefly tell you, Reese is not just a super, we're talking rally cross hill climbing global rally. We're talking he's also a stuntman as well. I got to, hey, listen to these movies that right off hand. Everybody knows Tokyo Drift. He was a stunt driver there, as well as the Dukes of Hazzard that came out several years ago. And Mr. and Mrs. Smith, if you guys remember Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, he was in there as a stunt driver. So that tells you, Reese is like unbelievable. Reese, let me ask you something. How did you, and how did you get involved in this? Because we know the background, but how did you get involved in all aspects of hill climbing, rally, Baja 1000, just and keep going on and on all the exciting type of driving, not just what we call oval or drag race. We're talking things that are rough and tough.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's been an incredible journey, and the journey continues. For most drivers, they get kind of cornered into one form of racing, and that is their career. And they retire and they're kind of done. I was fortunate to grow up underneath my father, who we all lived in New Zealand. He moved in the late 70s to the US to pursue his career. I stayed in New Zealand with my mom, and when I finished high school, I came to the US to go to college and then work with my father and learn a trade. Yes. And then from that trade came an interest from racing mountain bikes competitively and successfully in New Zealand to transferring into four wheels in the US. And, you know, working with his staff, learning skill sets, going to college, doing business and so forth, starting my own company kind of alongside of what he was doing, but with my own programs, but always having that guidance of either success or failures. You always learn from things, and yes, and working alongside skilled engineers and fabricators and so forth to aid me in kind of growing my own business. So yeah, the foundation was there from, you know, just kind of idolizing what my father had achieved. And as you mentioned, there's not too many forms of motorsport that he hasn't touched. And then randomly just, I don't say it was a career path, but kind of followed him in various forms of motorsport. So, you know, he's won Daytona 500, he's won Bathurst 1000 in Australia as road racing events. He won the Mickey Thompson Short Course Off-Road Championship, yes, in the U.S. three years in a row in the stadium racing. Yes, Baja 1000. US rally champion, North American rally champion, Asia Pacific rally champion, Trans-Siberian rally champion.
Nice.
Pikes Peak overall, and held the record for 13 years, and kind of put an asterisk next to that for the last person to win on an all dirt road and hold that record for 13 years until that record was broken. So yeah, very successful and you know, a great individual to hand down knowledge. Randomly, not in the form of driving technique, because he was so busy and because he was always away traveling. I kind of had to develop that myself. But between, as you mentioned, racing and getting into the stunt world at a young age, it enabled me to do repetitive work. Film work is very repetitive. They will change camera angles, lenses, movement of the camera, and you're asked to be kind of pinpoint accurate and repeat your move. But in doing so, you can do slight little inputs of steering, of throttle, of brake, and so forth, and manipulate the vehicle. So it enabled me to build a great foundation that then transitioned to racing, and then the intensity of racing kind of and environments transitioned back to filming. So the two of them have been amazing for my career.
We're talking, that's an exciting career. Now, let me ask you something. We've heard the career, but I always ask because I thoroughly like to know, what was your first vehicle, Reese?
So my first street vehicle was a hand-me-down truck. Was an 88 Toyota pickup truck. It was just a standard cab. And that was kind of my go-to. My father purchased it. I paid half, and then I had to pay him $150 a month until the other half was paid off. And I was not allowed to modify it in any way, shape, or form, because if I had extra money, it should be going into his pocket to pay it off. And my first paycheck that I cleared, I purchased two wheels because I could only afford two at $72 each. And I put them on the driver's side only. So it looked, so as I walked up to the truck, I was like, oh yeah, I've got new wheels, but I really only had two.
Just on the driver's side.
Yep.
Reese. Oh my goodness. Hey, but look at what you got, a Toyota pickup, which what is the engine size? I can't remember but
that was almost like the 2.2, the 22 RE. Pretty robust four-cylinder engine.
Yes, it's almost like bulletproof. Yeah. You can do anything. So why? See, now that's think about it. Now that some people would think, oh man, just an old pickup truck. Like some, of course, the kid like me. At first, the first vehicle I got was like a Camaro, 69 Camaro. But to get a, I think about it now, to get a Toyota pickup truck and doing the things that you do, and I would say the blood that flows through your veins. I just knew in just a short period of time, or you got a truck that was already ready to jump a couple of hills or something.
It was kind of weird. It was kind of weird because my dad was in rallying. My uncle Steve was running the short course Toyota program driving. So I had a Steve Millen racing sticker on my truck parked in my dad's front driveway. And I think he was kind of like, well, this ain't cool. but it's, you know, I had to have a truck and you know, throw a dirt bike in the back, throw a mountain bike in the back. You know, just it made sense. And randomly, I've been through transitions of when you kind of get your first successes, you go buy a nice car and you live through that. And then now I've been back to a pickup truck for probably the last, 10 or 15 years.
Oh my goodness. And what, and now what type of truck is that? Just curious.
Ford, for no particular reason than the engine, the 6.7 liter diesel engine is absolutely amazing. We do all of our Baja racing. So as a tow vehicle and a daily driver, as a dually F-350,
Yeah. Okay. We're talking heavy duty. It will get you to your destination no matter what's in front of you. Wow, I can understand that. My goodness. Oh man. Well, let me ask you this, because I'm just curious. Now, we're talking back then, got into, like you said, bikes, motorcycles. Now, when did you first get into what we call a really big type of competition, I guess either rally or hill climbing? When did that actually start?
Yeah, oddly enough, I would say it was a little later than maybe I would have expected or what you would expect. You know, young kids these days that are coming from parents that have been successful are starting very, very young.
That's right. And their teens or so.
My dad was always of the nature that if you wanted it bad enough, you'll work for it. There was nothing handed out. There was no silver spoon.
That's cool.
And at 18, I was 18 and I was still riding my bike to college, ride my bike from college to his shop, work in the afternoons and ride at home. And that was 30 plus miles of training a day that I was still into bikes. He went away on a couple of races internationally when he was running the Asia Pacific Rally Championship. I found the keys in his bedroom and got in a little bit of trouble on the street, got escorted home by the cops a couple of times and told to park the car, and he never wants to see me or the car on the street again because I didn't have a license. And then I just got an ounce of exposure to speed and I was hooked. So he put me in a car in one of his rally cars. We went out for the day and he's like, here it is. This is the sensation. This is the feeling. But if you want it, you're going to have to work for it. So that was just a switch. I was hooked on the adrenaline rush, on the motion, on the feeling. And then more so from a background in design and art, it's hooked on the creativity of building, my own car and developing it and so forth.
Wow, Reese. Oh my goodness, that's exciting. Now, is there any part of your career that you're doing that you love more than one? Because I would think, like you were, stating like your dad, the different things, I would think, okay, Baja 1000 through the hot desert of Mexico.
And
you know what, Reese, I got to tell you this. I was blown away, and I'm an older gent. I think I probably have you about 10 years or two or something like that. But I just remember back in the early 70s, seeing footage on the big show back then that you can catch all the sports was called ABC Wide World of Sports.
Early
70s. And I was absolutely blown away on the Ford Bronco, the famous Ford Bronco that was zooming through with the big wing on the top.
Was Parnelli Jones. Yeah.
Parnelli Jones. I was blown away at 11 years old watching that. I said, if I ever get a chance, even though, boy, the roughness, the jawing, the knocking around and all that, I was blown away. I said, this is unbelievable. 1,000 miles through the desert, practically, of Mexico. The guys on the motorcycles and then the VW type. It was unbelievable. And I would think that's like drawing every bone, every fiber in your body. That would be something you would do maybe once in a while and maybe go over to go back.
Well, obviously, back in those days, that was leading technology. A car came with one shock. Well, to make it better, you put three shocks on it. I don't know if you actually gained any more travel. You just, the other two shocks just protected the single shock from blowing up. And then Mickey Thompson put big, large tires on the cars to increase the wheel travel by getting suspension movement out of the sidewall of the tire.
Yes.
So it, you know, that, that amazing that you actually bring that vehicle up. There's a series, it's actually our next race on the calendar, called the Nora Off-Road Championship. Operates two events for the year in Mexico and Baja, and yes, kind of celebrates and embraces all the old vehicles as well. So they have modern divisions and then the old classics. And yes, the Bronco, Parnelli Jones's Bronco, sold last year for over $1.5 million. A gentleman purchased it, entered it into the race, rolled it twice,
and still
made the finish line. So I think that car just gained even more kind of prestige and knowledge.
I would think that vehicle, you would buy it and not drive it, but you put it over to admire it and maybe drive it, not go out and take it out into real events.
I 100% agree with your statement and support it, but at the other side of things, yes, it's not the first time that vehicle's been rolled. It's had another wing, not the one and only original wing. I'm sure it's had multiple tires and bits and pieces throughout its career. But it was so I kind of tipped the hat to the gentleman that went out and actually used the thing. Was his intentions to roll it? I'm sure not. But it just kind of adds to the story of that vehicle. And then now you skip forward to modern, what is referenced as a trophy truck. These are tube frame trucks. The tires have gone from, say, 32 inches in diameter to 40 inches. The shocks have gone from maybe 6 or 7 inches of travel to 30 plus inches of travel. The engines have gone from still a V8, but a V8 that used to produce back then maybe 300 horsepower is now 1,000 horsepower. So the jarring of the teeth and the backaches and all of that are completely gone. And the visual aspect of processing the terrain as it's coming to you at 100, 130 miles an hour and not feeling it through your body is absolutely mind-blowing, the capabilities of the engineering that has gone into these modern trucks.
Reese, you just said it. The technology and engineering over the last 40 to 50 years and racing as a whole, it just absolutely blows me away. It's amazing. Like you said, you could be in that truck and have a smooth ride like you're in some sort of Cadillac or Range Rover. You're just floating over and you're hitting some of the biggest humps there is. But the shock, it's amazing. I watch the trophy trucks and it's amazing. It's amazing on how the suspension, wheel camber. It's a whole nother ball game. There, I tell you. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it truly is.
Oh, that is something. So getting back, what particular type of, since you're into everything, what do you like doing the most or the best that you prefer? Or with me, I probably would love every minute of everything.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've kind of maybe taken slightly different path to most. And I'll get into maybe reasons why.
Sure.
But I think a lot of young kids will look at motorsport and go, I want to be an F1 driver or I want to be a NASCAR. And there's a lot of fame, there's a lot of limelight that goes with that. I think F1 has a very short term for a driver. NASCAR obviously has a longer term as a driver, as a career. But neither of them, number one, you've got to have a pathway into the seat, which didn't present itself from where I was. But globally looking at what I have touched and what I've done, it was really more engineering based. And I really have thoroughly enjoyed the development process of the vehicles, with the driving just being kind of the execution of the program. Didn't need to be on camera. I just wanted to go out and drive. And
yes,
From starting in rallying, doing a couple of years, destroying a car, going and working for someone else to save money, and then building another car and destroying that was the start of my career. And that was very successful. We got our first manufacturer sponsorship, which was a very good program from Mitsubishi Motors of America. And we were running, then was the Mitsubishi Lancer Evolution, four-wheel drive turbo platform in the US Rally Championship.
Yes.
And then along came this odd sport of drifting.
We're gonna get into the drifting thing, but go ahead, Reese.
Was around 2003, and the import market, especially on the West Coast, was really kind of dominated by drag racing. And again, that just wasn't enough of a driving outlet for me. I had zero interest in it, but it was deeply entrenched into the import market, which my company was at that point selling and making and installing and shipping a ton of performance parts and accessories. But the drag racing just did nothing for me. So drifting came along as an exhibition in 2003, and we actually took our four-wheel drive rally car out there and qualified first. And then they kind of told us that, well, now you're going to go tandem side by side with someone. And I just said, these two vehicles' dynamics are totally different. I'm going to crash into him, or he's going to crash into me. Yes. So I just bowed out of the event, but we qualified first. But I took away from that experience the crowd reaction and the crowd respect for the car control aspect. And I was like, well, this is exactly the same as sliding around dirt that I've been doing in the backwoods with only, you know, a couple of raccoons and squirrels cheering me on, so to speak. But now you put it in a stadium format. Yes. Let's go pitch this to some manufacturers. So continue the story a little bit longer. We went to the SEMA show. I met some folks. I already had my focus on what the vehicle was going to be, which kind of comes full circle to your story. And I'd watched a great Jeremy Clarkson edition of Top Gear, where he drove the Australian produced Holden Monaro, which was about to be branded in the US as the Pontiac GTO.
GTO, yes.
So I went to SEMA, got some contacts, purchased a plane ticket, and went and stood in front of 14 execs at GM and Pontiac division and said, you guys need to be involved with this sport. My dad had handed me down information again on what was referred to as a launch budget. And that is when a manufacturer has a new model vehicle and they have probably a 40% greater spend than they will have on the following years for marketing advertising. So I pitched a program on being the first domestic US manufacturer with a V8 into the sport of drifting. And we got that program. We're very successful in that program. And we built out the Pontiac brand from the GTO to the Solstice GXP, winning the US Drift Championship and winning the World Drift Championship in 2008.
Whoa. My goodness. See, that's amazing. And then on top of that, you said a big V8, because we're so used to looking at the smaller cubic inch engines.
It was very, again, Japanese influenced with turbocharged four-cylinder engines. But the style of the driving was very kind of intermittent, engine RPM falling off and then engine RPM ramping up. And they were having to do a lot of clutch work to get the engine RPM up higher, where a V8 kind of morphed into a more progressive throttle trace because you had the instant torque down low. So after that, pretty much everyone followed. Dodge jumped in, Ford hopped in, everyone came in, but it was really kind of our program and Pontiac, rest their souls, is gone.
I know it. I'm telling you. And now I see here a lot of people, which I wish I would have jumped on maybe that last year GTO. My goodness, it seemed like Pontiac went out with a blast
the G6 or the G8, I think it was. Yeah, yes. The very last model. Dang, so, you know, it was a great transition.
Yes. Please.
And we looked at so many aspects when we started drifting. You know, I had influence from speedway, dirt speedway, midgets and the big cars with the big wings on the roof. And we had Lexan vertical plane spoilers on the car to create a lot of sideways grip. And we would just dominate in that. And then they would come out with a new rule and ban that. And then we would change something else and they would ban that. So they actually brought me in as a consultant to work with the series to kind of give ideas. And we came up with kind of now, which is a foundation for a tire width to vehicle weight rule. And it's kind of evened out the playing field. But it was great to have an influence from the sport. Again, think from an engineering standpoint of not just what you're doing here, but how many other forms of motorsport could influence this. It wasn't road racing. It wasn't a stiff spring raid. It was kind of the complete opposite. And we were, maybe 10 years ahead of the curve when we jumped in there.
You think about it, Reese, you're stating that you were right there at the beginning, especially in the U.S. Of course, like you said, they've been zooming around the streets of Japan for a while with the drifting scene, but you are right there at the very I would say beginning of it here, because I must say, as an old gearhead, I remember, you know, watching some, and actually I've been to SEMA on numerous occasions. I remember I was back in SEMA in 2006 and they had a gentleman out there doing, and again, I remember they said, oh, this is some drifting, and they had like in the center of the parking lot with a guy with a black GTO was zooming around, just showing people. He was just zooming around, no helmet, no anything, just showing people. And you know, it was ho-hum, okay, yeah, it's okay. A number of people were watching, but like you said, now you got the young people, you got the generation, I would say like the Gran Turismo generation. Folks from the videos who are selling out arenas with drift. I think about, you know, our Von Gooden and Chelsea right now. I think he's the head of the points and American in the drift.
Formula Drift. Yeah.
Formula. Yep. Thank you, Reese. Yeah, Formula Drift. So, and it's amazing. It's a big V8 Mustang. So it's not the Z's, the Turbo Z's or anything. It's a big Mustang. So that it's amazing on how things have changed. And I must say, Reese, at the beginning, I quite did not understand drifting as a whole many, many years ago. And I said, well, here, my buddies and gearheads, and again, we've done our little racing on the side. We're all about traction. We needed to have the best grip all the way around. And here we go, guys, are zooming around with no traction and just what's going on here? And now,
that's a little bit of the educational side that I think maybe a lot of people don't quite understand a drift car. If you revert back to what I said earlier about a sprint car going around a dirt track. It's sliding, but it's sliding for speed. And they're trying to find as much grip in that setup from anti-squat to staggering tires to tire pressures to compounds to slip angle and throttle control and everything. And a drift car is no different. You know, we run rear sway bars on some tracks, you know, bars on, bars off, shock settings, camber settings, toes, tire pressures. You are sliding, but to get a competitive advantage, you need to slide away from your competitor that you're running door to door with. And that's built into grip. So if you actually, sliding around a corner is slower than grip driving around a corner. Mm-hmm, but in the essence of the sport, the slide speed is at its highest point with its highest angle. And that is just another respect level of car control to consistently be able to place the car in the proximity of the required zones and up against the walls. These cars are very, very fast.
Reese, I am blown away on the control. See, that's why I'm like, I am blown away now and just watching the Formula Drift. For the control of the car at those speeds, it's like, how can I say it? It's like ballet without slamming. It's unbelievable. I am blown away, and I'm going to be honest. I tried it one time. I have a Mustang Mach 1. I tried one time in a road course we have here outside of Houston, and I'm done. There's no way. There's no way. I smelled my clutch material. So I said, I'm not. This is not going to happen. We're talking about you got to give it to him. I'm blown away. I love it. I tell guys, yeah. At first I didn't. Now I catch it every week. Every week I'm watching Formula Drift. and as a sport, a couple of weeks ago, Reese, I was watching the stadium in which they were doing it over on the West Coast was sold out. It was completely sold out. It's amazing. Yeah, some other motorsports don't sell out like that. So.
Well, it's very, you know, if you take today's audience, younger generation being fed with so many forms of entertainment and continuously clicking on new forms of entertainment, either less than a minute or less than 10 seconds. The spectacle in front of you as a round is very short. It's very decisive. And effectively, you know, within say 2%, the younger generation can decide who won, what was good, and move on and restack another pair. A lot of other forms of motorsport, say IndyCar racing or NASCAR racing, mm-hmm. Is over a long duration of time, and you can watch the opening two laps, three laps, go crack open a beverage, make a bowl of chips, and come back, and the entertainment is effectively going to be the same maybe until the last 5 or 10 laps. So the formula works. And so I think it's very engaging, and it keeps, you know, the older and the younger generation on the edge of their seat, just in anticipation of what's about to happen, which is a condensed version of really any other form of, say, traditional U.S. motorsport.
Yes, definitely.
And wow. And the funny thing was from drifting, you know, at that same time, the spectacle that I recognized in the crowd's reaction when we went to that first event, then going to and landing a program with a manufacturer, and then kind of having that manufacturer kind of rebirthing them for an exciting brand. At the same time, the studios paid attention to what was going on and what this movement was. And you had Fast and the Furious as an installment that had two very successful movies, all based around the car culture with a mixture of domestic US and Japanese vehicles. Yes. They reached out to me and said, hey, we're building this new movie. We'd like you to be a part of it as a consultant. And then we want to have a meeting. We had a meeting. We talked that we were actually involved in the sport in the US.
Yes.
So we ended up building, I don't know, like 12 cars for that movie. I became the lead driver. I put together a driving team and worked with the director and really helped them understand, even from camera angles and bits and pieces, the capabilities that we could actually do naturally with the cars, so we didn't have to green screen and fake this out. And we did a lot of amazing things. And I think even that movie was, you know, just elevated the sport to another level.
Oh,
Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift.
You better believe it. I'm telling you, I'm here like in one of my rooms. I have like a whole wall of Fast and the Furious posters going around. So yes, it changed the whole scene. That really showed everybody that. Oh, anyway, we can go on with that. That's exciting. Reese, we got to jump in what you've been doing this year. Because I think about the early summer we're looking at the Pikes Peak run there that you're doing, and I guess you were running, and I kind of saw some footage there with the Pennzoil BMW M8.
Yeah, it was another amazing year. Pikes Peak has a huge history for my family. Yes. This was my 28th running personally. And my father first ran there in 1981 in a rally car, and then developed a vehicle, and he had a program with Toyota, which is kind of an iconic vehicle. People just reference as the Pennzoil Celica, which he won in 1994, set an all-new world record that held for 13 years. The road in 2001 started to get paved 1 mile each year over 12-mile course. And in 2012, randomly for the first year of being a full paved road, I won and set an all-new world record overall. So it was kind of an asterisk for him on the dirt, and then an ending to that kind of that time period where it's now all paved and we were the first to win. So it's been a great event, and every year I look for a new challenge and a new partnership. And this year we put together a program with BMW. We went up there for the production car world record title. And yes. We ended up breaking that record by 8 seconds and ran the Pennzoil BMW M8, which is an incredible platform if no one knows. It's 4.4 liter twin turbo V8, four wheel drive, 0 to 60 as a production car in under 3 seconds. It's the most subtle looking car when you walk up to it, but the hit when you punch the throttle is absolutely incredible.
Unbelievable. Whoa.
And that car is going on auction for anyone who's interested here very shortly.
Are you kidding me?
on Bring a Trailer.
Bring a Trailer. So, yes.
Yeah. So that car is going to go up on auction here. I'm guessing in about 4 to 6 weeks.
Unbelievable. I gotta get in contact with that.
So slightly used, under 5,000 miles. There you go. There's your new weapon of choice.
That's right. Just used to break the record, the Pikes Peak, and that's it. Oh my. Let me ask you. You have done Pikes Peak several times with. We're talking Bentley, Continental G. What's the best feeling car you have driven? Moving up that Pikes Peak. Course.
I think you have to be specific to styles of events.
Yes.
I have to put it down. So we ran for Hyundai for about 7 or 8 years.
Yes.
With a contract with them after GM in 2008. GM kind of, you know, through the, I don't want to call it what. Guess it was a recession.
Yes.
And every race team was released. I kind of saw the writing on the wall early, and we had pitched Hyundai on a program and transitioned in that year from out of one manufacturer to into a new manufacturer, and we had great success with them and Time Attack and Drift and Rally Cross. But we also had a program parallel, and for 2 years we ran a Time Attack program, a Drift program, and a Rallycross program. So I was bouncing around the U.S. Just putting on different helmets and suits and changing my driving style. And then Pikes Peak as well was – we had the opportunity to build a four-wheel drive turbocharged car that was quite a weapon, about 850 horsepower, 1,800 pounds. Unfortunately, the road just wasn't quite there, but we were building the car about 2 years ahead of where the road was going to be. Hyundai stopped supporting that program. Unfortunately, that car now lives out its days in a museum. But the following year, another team contracted us to assist building them an electric version of that same car. And we ended up winning over all and being the first electric car to win against standard combustion engine cars. That was a four-wheel drive prototype with about 1,400 horsepower. One of the most exhilarating feelings driving that car on the burst speed, it was 0 to 60 in like 1.6 seconds. Pretty much had a toggle switch that you just put into forward or you could put into reverse. So I'm assuming it could do that same speed if you attempted to in reverse. Never did. But the torque force on your body was absolutely amazing. And obviously, because there's no compression of air to make power, there was zero loss of power at altitude. So for the viewer, for your listeners, the standard rule of thumb for altitude, if you climb 1,000 feet, you lose 3% of air density. So that is downforce and that is power on compressing the density of the air. So the start line of Pikes Peak is just shy of 10,000 feet. So for a non-turbo or normally aspirated engine, you've lost 30% of your power at the start line. An electric car has lost nothing. And at the finish line, you're up another 1,400 feet. So you've lost 44% of your power. So if you had, let's just call it close for round numbers for basic math, it's close enough to 50%. If you had 500 horsepower at sea level, you've got 250 horsepower up there. An electric car that's 500 horsepower keeps 500 horsepower.
Whoa. Now that changes the whole scheme of things with an EV vehicle. I'm telling you.
100%. And
that
that's
changes
why
the game, Reese.
People paid attention to what we did as a three-man crew, and it caught the wind of Volkswagen, and they came with an incredible effort, you know, like a $40 million program, and they went and took effectively, I don't want to say it was our technology, but the basics of what we had put together and built an incredible car with an amazing test program and went and shattered that record. We were at about 8:40 seconds. We had a tire that was too soft per my choice, my fault. We would have done about an 8:20 and they came in and did a 7:57 or something.
My goodness.
So it really showcases the technology and burst speed in a single environment where an internal combustion engine car would struggle to compete. So the electric car was high on my list as far as just unique experiences to Pikes Peak.
Whoa, see, that was one of my questions, Reese, I was going to ask you. How do you feel about running an EV in one of these performance uphill? And you've just said it. It's almost like a no-brainer, but you still got your old school guys who said, I don't want EVs nowhere inside. Yeah, no, I'm internal combustion, turbo, supercharged, whatever. You still got a whole boatload of people who still think that way, Reese. Yeah.
If you go to a car show and use, let's call start up, because you can't call it fire up, a Tesla, there's zero emotion connected to that. Yes, it's going to be fast. Yes, it's going to be an impressive feeling, but there's zero full emotional connection. You go start up any old car or a good performing, you know, say European or Japanese car, and the smells, the sounds, they make you smile. And there's no replacing that full connection of an experience. And I think the EV world has a place, clearly. For a race course like Pikes Peak, it's 12 miles long. Its duration is under 10 minutes, and the altitude is a performance gain factor. But anything other than that in racing, and it just does not work, especially in endurance racing. For public use, Sure, it has a purpose, but then again, it's still very short range. So, a tip of the hat again to the technology, but it definitely shouldn't be something that should be being forced upon us as a transition into 100% EV.
Yes, it's going to be, if you think about it as a whole, every automaker has their line of EVs or and hybrids, but still, they still have their line of gasoline engines. I think about the Chrysler Dodge group where they came out, was a year or so ago, I remember seeing they pulled out the new Dodge Charger EV. But what got me rolling is, how are you going to pipe out a revving engine sound? Just pipe, you know, here it is, full EV, but let's pipe out somewhere underneath you and hear this revving speaker that giving you an engine sound. That's not quite the same.
It's funny you mentioned that car, because for the last 10 years, I've done all of their performance driving for their TV commercials for Chrysler and the Hellcat Challenger and Charger. So big smoking tires, big sideways, and randomly drove. And I am the only one who's driven to this date, actually the one of one EV Charger, which we did a few months.
Reese?
A few months ago. So I'm very aware of the sounds and everything you talk about. And even surprisingly modern manufacturers, Ford, Toyota. Toyota has the new Tundra, of which I've driven for TV commercials. And I hopped in the car and I drove it. Well, I'd already done the research. I knew it was a twin turbo 3.5 liter V6 and closed the door, put in a drive and stomped on the throttle. And I'm like, that is not a V6. And I put it in park. Yes. And I revved it and I'm like, that's a V8. And then I opened the door and then I revved it. And then I heard a whisker. And I'm like, that's a V6. Closed the door again. And then I put my ear down towards my knee and they're plump. As you said, they're plumbing in a sound to offset the noise, to make it sound more throaty, gutsy, manly than what it actually is. But in saying so, separate to a sound, a modern V6 twin turbo is absolutely impressive, the torque and power that you can get out of them.
Yes. Now, Reese, I have to ask you this. Since you have been the big man driving the SRT Challengers, have you had a chance to drive the new, Charger or Challenger with the new Hurricane twin turbo engine yet?
No, not that one. I'm chomping at the bit.
Okay. I was waiting for you to give us the feeling there. Oh my goodness. I can't wait because I know you will be behind the wheel eventually. So
I'm sure the call will come here shortly. Yeah, they were going to do a special send off of like the last vehicle. But they decided not to produce a commercial around that. But, about 6 years ago, actually also linked to Pennzoil. We did an incredible campaign that your listeners can look up on YouTube called Joyride. And we went around the world to the most iconic places and tracks with partners that they had with BMW and Dodge. And went to, I think we were the first to drift the entire Nürburgring course in a BMW M4. We went up to the Kananaskis Mountains in Calgary and did an incredible piece in the snow. We went to Baja with the supercharged Jeep on 40-inch tires and romped through the desert down there. We were in Pittsburgh. We were in Miami in the last Viper off the production line. And all of those pieces are incredible to watch and view. And it's all done in production vehicles, which is to me the most satisfying, because you do not have the steering modifications, the handbrakes, any of that sort of stuff that say a true performance drift car or racing car would. So yeah, really, really fun pieces. And it's just amazing to kind of just be in the whole culture of production car manufacturing on the front line, and then motorsport. So yeah, it's been amazing.
Yes, Reese, I have to bring this up again. Reese, I have seen the Joyride videos maybe 1,000 times. me being here on our technical department where we answer all the oil questions, transmissions, you know it, from all of our natural gas base oils. But I must tell everybody out there, please go online, go to YouTube, and pull up Joyride, and you will see these videos will blow your socks off. And I know most of you've already seen it, but you gotta see it. And you know what? I haven't seen it in probably a few months, but Reese, you already got me excited again. I gotta go back and watch you. Oh my goodness, the Viper, off the ground. Hey, we're talking, think about the, I get excited. I'm sorry, everyone out there, because you guys know I get excited over our product and motorsports. The one video with the SRT wide body Challenger, Reese, wheels off the ground when it started. I'm done. I was in heaven. I said, this is something. And it's just so, it's like a, how can I say it? Everyone out there, it's like a brilliant car type of movie. You guys know Fast and the Furious. Go over here and check this. You will not forget it. I'm telling you, you will watch it over and over again. A number of my friends, I've told them about it over the years, and they have jumped on there, and it's been something else. I tell you, Reese, I'm blown away, Reese. You know, I can talk to you probably another couple of hours, but whoa, I know you're a busy man, and I can just go on and on everything that you do. Now, let me ask you, we're about to go into another year, because I tell you, Reese, the year is flying so fast, we can't keep up. But what's anything happening for 2024? Can you believe we're right here in the middle of another decade? Anything happening that we need to know about in your area?
Nothing in stone yet. We have some irons in the fire, as you always do, with maybe, you know, three or four different possibilities. You know, when we can talk further about those, or they develop, we need to revisit this for closing out 2023. We have two more events, the NORA 500, which will be just customers running out of our shop here. It's a 500-mile event down in Baja, done over 2 days in stages, very similar to what the Dakar Rally is. Yes. And then the granddaddy of them all is the Baja 1000 that will be in November. And that is a peninsular year. So every third year, they run a peninsular race. So it starts up in Ensenada and finishes down in La Paz traditionally. Over 12 to 1300 miles with a green wag waved and a checkered flag waved. And anything and everything that develops in between it is on the clock. So you have to be experienced, you have to be patient, and you have to push when you need to. You have to conserve fuel, you have to conserve tires, you deal with fog and dust and nighttime running over 22-hour nonstop race. That is the big one for the year. And to throw a curveball in it, they've gone and they're starting it down south and heading north. So all the backside of the bumps are going to be square edged and gnarly, and it's just going to make that course just even rougher and tougher. But what an incredible adventure. Something I sign up for every year. Some people do just as a bucket list. But yeah, that'll close out our 2023, and then we can kind of get going and back focused for 2024.
Wow, Reese, that is Reese, you have to be in very good shape for that kind of, I'm telling you, for that type of race, I would say. My goodness, and hydrated too. My goodness. Well, Reese, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on Michael's Motor Alley. I certainly would like to get with you maybe a little bit next year and see what's happening. I thank you so much for being here. Is there any way or any, I guess, social media address where people can follow you?
Yeah, for sure. On Instagram, mostly is at Rhys Millen Racing, RHYSMILLEN Racing. And then, yeah, we frequently post what we're doing in motorsport. And then there's always an embargo on filming. The filming things that I just did the last 2 weeks, I can't post about during the week. And I have to sit on them now until I think one of them comes out in January. But some of the most insane stuff that I've done, period. And I just have to sit here and go, I want to tell the world about this, but I can't. But they will always eventually pop up on our Instagram page.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Wow. Well, that's nice. That's nice. So everyone got the address there? Check it out. And go, I'm telling you, go on YouTube and check out a lot of the things that Rhys have done. Oh, my goodness. And the family as a whole. It's so much juicy stuff out there. It's exciting, I tell you. Well, Rhys, once again, thank you for hanging out with me for a little while and just discussing your background. It's just so exciting. I'm telling you, it's so exciting. So, Rhys, we will let you go, buddy. You take care and be safe and good luck on the big Baja 1000 at the end of the year. And everyone out there, thank you for listening. Stay safe. Keep the motor oil in motion. And we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for keeping the motor oil in motion with me. Stay safe. I will see you next time.
You've been listening to Michael's Motor Alley, presented by Pennzoil. Michael's Motor Alley podcast is available for listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just hit the subscribe or follow button to stay up to date on new podcast episodes. This podcast has been produced by Pennzoil, and the views and opinions on this podcast are those of the people featured and not of Shell or its affiliates. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.